So good morning. So the topic is partitioning, how elements partition. And I'm a mineral physicist, so that will be the point of view of the lecture. So just to give an overview of why partitioning matters for this particular CIDR workshop, I'm citing Francis Albaret from his textbook here. So the Earth dynamics are controlled by two types of mechanisms. First type is differentiation mechanism, whereby elements are fractionated, which means that between two faces, they have unequal contents. And mixing mechanisms that tend to erase these fractionation processes. So geochemists have kind of mapped these heterogeneities. This plot, this plot is strontium lead isotope systematics in oceanic basalts. A wide variety of N members appear, which are labeled with these capital letters. And they show you that the source of this basalt in the mantle are different, so you have heterogeneities. The question is, where do these chemical heterogeneities stem from, and can that be tested geophysically? Okay, so to be able to test geochemical heterogeneities by seismological methods, you need to have different material properties, different elastic properties, and if you have different densities, that really helps. So the major heterogeneities that people have mentioned a lot before, or large low shear velocity provinces that you see on tomographic models in red here on the global maps. They might well be enriched in silicon and in iron, and if they are enriched in iron, then that's interesting because iron is a heavy element. So we probably are interested here in looking at iron partitioning. If you want to test the presence of crust, either oceanic crust recycled at depth, like this green blobs in this main panel here, you might want to trace particular elements such as trace elements, okay, in the source. So very generally, a partition coefficient is just the ratio of concentrations, either molar or in weight. The outline is to explain you a little bit how it's measured for trace elements, how we can be predictive when we can't measure, either in pressure, temperature, or in composition. I'll talk about how the melt structure influence partition coefficient, because generally I'll be talking about melt mineral partitioning here, because that's what generates heterogeneities. Okay? You can look at partitioning between minerals themselves, that's very interesting in many areas. You can look at partitioning between fluids, that's also very interesting, but here, because we're talking about deep mantle heterogeneities, I'll really focus on mineral liquid, silicate liquid partitioning. Okay, so we'll talk about melt structure, and we'll talk about one case for the major element with iron. So in classical petrology, of course, you're interested in partitioning because that tells you the melt fraction. You have a rock that melts, it's always partial melting in the Earth. So the fraction of melt, which is F, you can get it if you know the concentrations and of elements and if you know their partition coefficients. So the formula is different if the melting process is different, if it's at equilibrium or not. But basically, you need the partition coefficient to need the fraction of the melt. But it can tell you much more to know the partition coefficient. It can tell you about the mineralogy of the source. It can tell you about the pressure, temperature conditions of melting, and oxygen fugacity eventually as well. And I'm talking here about melting, but we can talk more generally about any process that fractionate elements, such as a differentiation event, like crust formation. Of course, when you want to have big pictures of fluxes between reservoirs, you need this partitioning coefficient. And when you want to date the formation of reservoirs or differentiation event, you also need to know the partition coefficient. It's often implicit, but it's there. So that's an example from core formation on the moon, in this case, where you look at hafnium tungsten partitioning. And you get different evolution of the tungsten epsilon value depending on this hafnium tungsten ratio, which reflects the hafnium tungsten partitioning. Okay, so if you want to really put a date facing an epsilon tungsten value, you need to know partitioning. Okay, so Goldschmidt, of course, has been the pioneer scientist on this topic. He classified the elements into four main groups because he had this idea that the Earth was born molten and that you had these four coexisting shells, the atmosphere, the molten silicate Earth. He thought at the time that there was an iron sulfide layer on top of the iron core, so that was making these four groups. Atmophile, they go in the atmosphere. Lithophile elements, they go in the silicate ocean. Siderophile, they go in this FES shell, and siderophile, they go in the core. So we're interested here in a subclass of geochemical affinities. When you melt silicate and you have a residue, a crystalline residue, then you have the notion of compatible element, an element that prefers to get into the crystallographic structure of a mineral is compatible. If it prefers to go in the melt, it's incompatible. So Goldschmidt also understood, that's one of his rules, that the principal controls on partitioning are the mismatch in valence and radius between the substituent and the substituted ion. And he drew this sketch where you understand the importance of ionic charge and ionic radius in this process of substitution of elements. Okay, so back to some basics. I already mentioned the partition coefficient, concentration ratio. If you have several minerals coexisting with a melt, you can define a bulk partition coefficient, which is just the sum of the several mineral melt partition coefficients. Sometimes it's useful to compare two partition coefficients. That's called the exchange partition coefficient. It's particularly useful to compare iron and magnesium, for instance. So when you want to measure partitioning ratios for trace elements, you need to be able to measure very low abundances because you want to be as close as possible to real earth processes. And in real earth processes, you have very, very low abundances of these rare earth elements, for instance. So you could do that by standard electron microprobe analysis, but you can go down to 100 ppm for rare earth, which is not too good. So these days, people do laser ablation, ICP-MS, or ion microprobe analysis. They can do much better accuracy down to PBB or PPT level, or it depends on the element. And you don't always go to the PPT level. It really depends. And the good thing about these methods, both laser ablation and SIMS, that you do point analysis. You don't need to destroy the whole sample, so you see where you shoot, and you can target areas in your samples. So if samples are very, very small, you can even use nano-SIMS with few nanometers size spot. So just an example, the top panel, it's an SEM image of an experimental sample. It was an equilibration of a melt with olivine and clinopyroxenes, and the dark spots are the laser ablation spots. Okay. So when you do the measurements, you get this kind of data, so it's counts per second, and you get a plateau. In order to get concentration out of this data, you need calibrants, and which means that you need to have good standards for your minerals, and that can be tricky sometimes, especially when you work with very high pressure minerals that you don't find necessarily in nature in large crystals size. In any case, that's how you do that. And I'll come back to this plot here where Fonseca measured the partitioning coefficient of tungsten between olivine and silicate melt as a function of the oxygen fugacity, which is plotted here compared to the quartz phyllite magnetite buffer. Okay, so that gives you an idea of the accuracy of the measurements anyway. You have to be careful that you're, when sometimes you need to measure something. So because of the accuracy of the machine, the detection limits, sometimes you need to work with higher concentration than natural. When that happens, you have to be careful that the partitioning process in nature is the same as in your experiment. If it's not the case, you break the Henry's law. So you have to be sure that your partitioning process is not affected by concentration. I'm just showing a case where it can happen that it's not the same process when you put too much of an element. In that case, sorry, it's platinum, I didn't mention. So what you see on these SEM images, so that's the whole sample. It was a silicate melt in a graphite capsule. And the zoom on the border shows you bright spots. Okay, in the quench sample. So they're called micro nuggets or nano nuggets, depending on their size. And you, when you do these experiments, you always do that on a quench sample. You don't measure the partitioning in situ at high temperature. So when you have these nuggets, you don't really know what to do with them. You don't know if they existed at high temperature in the melt or if they were exsolved during the quench. So in this case, you have a problem which is not easy to solve, okay? But in most cases, for lithophile elements, that doesn't happen. Okay, that's a problem for siderophile elements. That's also a problem for volatile elements. But for lithophile, we are usually okay. So a very classical spider diagram for partition coefficients between upper mantle minerals and basalts. So clearly, garnet has the most striking diagram here. So garnet is the host of incompatible elements in the upper mantle. So you really see the signature of garnet at the residue. I have to point out here that most of the studies of partition coefficients are done, obviously, at ambient pressure. That's where most of the literature is. You do have high-pressure data, but most of them are done using piston cylinder presses, and a piston cylinder goes to 3.4 GPa. Okay, so it's really upper mantle. I'll show you what we can do at higher pressures, but really, really, the vast literature is between 0 and 3.4 GPa. Okay, so if you want to track heterogeneity in the mantle, I told you earlier, you want very often to track basalts or eclogites at depth. Yeah. So eclogites, when you put a mold at high pressures, the crystalline faces are different from the surrounding mantle. Particularly in the lower mantle, you have much more calcium brutmanite than in the normal mantle. Normal mantle has a bit less than 10% calcium brutmanite. So it's, and you have stishovite that appears. And if I go toward the surface, what really matters is garnet, which is actually majorite at these pressure conditions. Okay, so there are data on, there are actually one paper on majorite melt partitioning by Korn et al. It does have partition coefficient above one, so it does take quite a lot of rare earth elements in this area as well, like the low-pressure garnets do. I have to say that there are basically no data, published data on the transition zone minerals like ringwoodite or wurtzlerite. Okay, that might not matter too much for heterogeneities in the mantle, these faces, but it's just for you to know. If you go down in the lower mantle, Kay Hirose said in a recent paper that calcium brichmanite is the garnet of the lower mantle. Right. Calcium brichmanite, when you look at this partition coefficient, the upper panels are for calcium brichmanite, the lower panels for magnesium brichmanite. If you look at the y-axis, clearly you put a factor of 100 more trace elements in the calcium brichmanite compared to magnesium brichmanite. So it's a very efficient host of rare earth element, the calcium brichmanite. Even better than garnet. Okay, so these three groups are similar set of data. Okay, so kind of a good agreement there. Okay, so record high pressures. Paper is about to be published. Japanese group. They went to the bottom, very bottom of the mantle using diamond anvil cells. So you have a picture of the diamond anvil on the top left. So you see the diamond cullet. There is a rhenium gasket, 50 micron hole. So that's the size of your samples. Sample is very small. So that was a glass. Initially, they just put a glass in it, silicate glass. And they shoot with the laser. They melt it, and the melt portion quenches as a dark spot. It's always like that when you shoot with a laser. So you have this dark spot is the melt, and the surrounding is the unmelted area. You can recover the samples these days with the FIB techniques, when you make thin slices. So that's what you see in the middle panel. These very large bubbles, actually not bubbles, they're laser pits. And they did laser ablation, ICP-MS, to measure the trace element contents and measure elements actually. Was measured as well by EPMA. What is very good with this technique, diamond anvil cell, they also did in situ X-ray diffraction. So they had the partition coefficient on the recovered samples back to their home institute, and they also know what were the crystalline faces at high PNT. Okay, so they can control the crystallography. Okay, anyway, so you know that's what they get, and so that is possible. Well, that's very new, but that's possible, okay? If we want to push the experiments even further.
Question.
Yeah.
Good morning. Can I take you back just a couple of slides, because you've just told us something I didn't know at all, which was that garnets and calcium brichmanite are a good place to put these heterogeneity, these trace elements. Should we be trying to develop some intuition about why that's the case? Is it just because calcium is big? Or should we as a group be trying to think about, you know, the logic behind this and the systematics there?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. I'm going there. It's all about the crystallography sites of garnet. Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you.
And have the space to go there, absolutely. So if you want to push the experimental limits, well, you can certainly use the nanoseams with DAC experiments. You've seen the laser spots here. They're quite massive compared to the size of the sample. So when you work with diamond anvil cell, very high pressure experiments, you want to switch to the nanoseams, you know, smaller spots. Although I don't have data to show you, I think I understand that people are working on partitioning experiments from shock experiments. The cases where they can recover the samples. And what I'm going to mention a bit more in detail is X-ray fluorescence. X-ray fluorescence is a method that allows you to measure the partitioning coefficient in situ. And by in situ, I mean at high pressure and temperature. Okay, so you can do it within your diamond anvil cell. Okay, diamond anvil, you can put the X-rays through, so that the sketch on top of it, so you can have the YAG laser to heat up your sample as well, and the X-rays or the yellow arrow here. Okay, so you do that, and you measure as a function of the X-ray energy some peaks, and basically the area of these peaks is a function of the concentration of the elements. Okay, so you also need standards. You know, you also need to calibrate for this calibration for this method, which is a bit challenging at the moment, but in principle, this is in development and it's getting there. So you, yeah, and that's an example of partitioning. In this case, they had put chondrite on top of iron foil to see partitioning between the chondrite and iron. And they could do some mapping, in this case, of some siderophile elements. And that's, in this case, that's siderophile elements, but the potential of this method is very important for anything that cannot be quenched, particularly volatiles elements. You never know when you quench an experiment if your volatile just exsolved or not. Okay, and that's really the way to go.
I have a question. You mentioned standards a couple of times already, and I understand that probably very important. I'm not geochemist, I don't know how these machines work, but one of the things I've been wondering is, eventually you're looking at ratios of concentrations. So can you, if you have counts which are proportional to abundance, which is an assumption on my part, then when you take the ratio, don't you, is it not possible to kind of remove that conversion from the actual measurements and the actual concentration, in which case you wouldn't need the standards?
Yeah, so first, I'm not a geochemist, but but I can answer you. That's often what people assume. So the high-pressure data I've shown you on majorite, that's what they assume. That's what they assume. But analysts will tell you that's a bit tricky because you can have matrix effects. So you better do that in the equivalent matrix. That's why. It doesn't seem to be a massive error if you don't consider it, but analysts will tell you you better have appropriate standards. Oh, thanks.
The experiments there, the analyses are very tricky. And Christelle said that the crater of the laser ablations were big. Yes, they're big relative to the size of the sample, but if I looked at the picture properly, 10 microns for a laser spot is actually very small, which makes indeed the analysis very tricky, especially because when you shoot with your laser, you basically send everything and anything in your instrument. So if you don't have a standard that has exactly the same composition, that composition, that's what we call the matrix effect, is biasing the data. And so those are very demanding analyses and very time consuming to do this properly and also to make sure that they are accurate.
Well, I have no doubt it's hard analysis. I just want to understand the detail.
Thank you. Okay, so that's what I wanted to tell you about the measurements themselves. Okay, so sometimes you're fine enough with the measurements. You have the measurements and you can immediately apply them to whatever you're interested in. Sometimes you cannot because what you're interested in has a very particular composition or a very particular PT path which has not been considered by experiments, in which case you need to have models. Okay. So if we want to go to models, we need to have a bit of thermodynamic basis. So just a couple of slides on that. So I've just put on the top a simple substitution of some trace elements in olivine. So let's say that's this element M substitute to magnesium in olivine. Okay, and this extraction is at equilibrium, that the free energy change must be, the delta G must be zero. So if you go back to what the Gibbs free energy is, you can get the partial derivative versus pressure here, which is equal to V. And for an ideal gas, this is easy to get. You can, from the partial derivative, get G as a function of P and T. That's easy, so it's a function of pressure. That's for just one element. But if you have many elements, because free energy is an extensive property, you can consider it's just the sum of the individual G for the different elements. So you can express it like that, and that's actually how you define a chemical potential. Okay, so those are for gases. So if it's a real gas, it's not pressure. It's not the partial pressure. It's what we call the gas fugacity. Okay, because in real gases, Yeah, but I didn't manage. Oops, I didn't put it on. Maybe that would help. Oh, thanks a lot. Sorry. So it can be it is smaller than the pressure here, the partial pressure, because you can have interaction, repulsive forces, okay, in a real gas. Okay, we don't work with real gases here, we work with condensed spaces, so it's a bit more complicated, and that's how you have the activity appearing in this equation here. Okay, the activity. And then the tricky bit is that mu zero is not a function of T alone, it's a function of T and P. Okay, and that's because you're looking at condensed spaces. Okay, so just following this, applying this equation to this reaction here. So the activities of the reactants here and of the products. You can gather everything, and you get the delta G as a function of the reaction constant, basically. Okay. Now, not everybody does that, but some do. Just for simplicity, you can assume that the non-ideality, which is the ratio between activity and concentration, you can assume that this non-ideality is the same in the mineral and in the melt. Okay. If you do that, then you just have the concentrations appearing in this equation. Okay, so it's very straightforward. And that's what you get, basically. So you get the partition coefficient of your trace element as a function of the partition coefficient of magnesium, where it substitutes versus exponential delta G0 over RT. Okay, so more generally, you have this form of equation. And yeah, you can develop delta G0 to get a function of T and P, because when you measure things, you will try to measure as a function of T and pressure. So you want to have a lot of data and regress the data against this kind of formalism. Okay? So that's the basic formalism. You can make it a bit more complex, but it's with such kind of formula, you'll find them. Be careful, this is kind of empirical, though. No? They add up as a function of oxygen fugacity. They can add up composition terms. And these composition terms is for the silicate melt. I'll come back later to that. NBO over T expresses the degree of polymerization of the melt. Okay, but that's kind of empirical. But anyway, if you have lots of data, as a function of pressure, temperature, FO2, composition of the melt, you can at least fit your data with this law, and then you have a model for petrogenic processes. Okay. So just to mention FO2 a bit more, I just said that they put in, you can find these equations where you have just a function of FO2 here. It's a bit more complicated. In fact, like in the case of tungsten partitioning between olivine and silicate, the behavior here is just not as simple. See here, okay? So it's well explained in these papers by Fonseca and Malman, in which they describe the partition coefficient as a function of partition coefficient of the two tungsten, because tungsten can be 4+ or 6+. Depending on its oxidation state. Anyway, so you have to be careful about having partitioning coefficient as a function of FO2. It can be more complex. And I'm showing this plot. It's actually, in this case, it's partitioning of tungsten between this black here, the triangles. Partitioning of tungsten between metal iron and silicate melt. And the overall figure is about partitioning of nickel, cobalt. Nickel and cobalt and siderophile elements in general, they have this tendency with pressure, they decrease a lot. And tungsten, you have this kind of kink here, which is very strange. It's opposite behavior. That's why Cottrell said, well, maybe because you have a change of oxidation state in the silicate melt. That could be. So to check that, you can do additional experiments. I like to X-ray absorption spectroscopy on a synchrotron. That was done on glasses prepared at high pressures, in this case. So what you see in X-arcs, you have the energy of the X-rays that is increased. You have a jump here, which is the absorption edge. So you look at tungsten environment. So X-arcs is sensitive, is chemically, it's a chemical probe. You only look at one element with X-arcs. So you go, you put the energy of your X-rays around the absorption edge of your element, and you look at the interaction afterwards. What matters here is just the position of this absorption edge. Okay, it's a bit empirical, but this absorption edge is, depends on oxidation state. And this you know from standards, by comparison with standards. So that's the position of this peak as a function of FO2. And all the glasses are here, actually. Whatever the pressure of the melt was. And they went up to 24 GPa. So they said, oh, well, there is no effect of pressure on tungsten oxidation. Well, that might be true, but remember that this is done on quenched glasses. So you never know what really happens at high pressure. Okay, so coming to your question, another way to model partitioning is to the so-called lattice strain model, which is much more explicit about where the elements go. So it gives you a strong physical basis for partitioning. So in garnet, for instance, the trace elements go in this big, big dodecahedral site, so they have space to go there. Okay, so the lattice strain model is based on calculating the energy to insert a dopant in a mineral. So that was derived by Bryce. So Bryce knew that partition coefficient depend on the ionic radius because Onuma had noticed this parabola before. Okay, those are called the Onuma diagrams. So you have this parabola here. Okay, so this delta G strain is actually quite straightforward to obtain if you just consider the strain, which is the ratio of pressure versus Young modulus. So basically, this is induced by inserting a dopant in this site, but you can assume that the variation of radius induced by this putting this dopant in there is compensated when you integrate from here to infinity, okay, in the inverse proportion. So that's basically, if you integrate this, you just get this expression quite quickly. And in this plot, K is partition coefficient. So he got a very nice fit of the, with the data. So that works very well. Okay, so if we go back to our own former thermodynamic formalism, you can express delta G here as with the delta G strain using the Bryce formula. Now that assumes that strain only affects the crystal. It assumes that there is no strain associated with putting the dopant in the melt. Okay? And we'll see that this might be wrong. But that's how it works. No strain in the melt, so delta G here is only associated with strain in the crystals. Okay, so that's what you get, and that, oh, sorry.
Is there any reason why here is Young's modulus instead of like other moduli, like bulk modulus?
There is a relationship between Young moduli and bulk moduli. Quite simple, if you use the Poisson's ratio. That's not a question, sorry.
Because I remember the paper in this Nature paper, they define this Young's modulus as like kind of like site Young's modulus.
Yeah, you're right. It's site. I didn't say it. It's site Young's modulus. You're perfectly right. Yes.
And not really the Young's modulus of the mineral. And yeah. I was just wondering, because if you insert something to a mineral site, the most intuitive way to think about it is going to be to compete to make this site expand.
Yep.
So that it's going to be more like a bulk modulus stuff instead of extended, like what Young's modulus describe.
It's a tricky question. Just to answer that, yeah, that's the relations between the Young modulus and the bulk modulus. But that's, I mean, your question is very pertinent. And we'll see that there are lots of problems with these assumptions. It's really an apparent site modulus. And we will see. There are problems with this. Yeah. It's not easy at all. So, yeah. So we're here with the Blondian Wood model, which has been extremely powerful for lots of to fit lots of data. Okay, it's really a great model. Now, in this model, you have this parabola, the Onuma parabola. Okay, so what you graphically, the D0 here is the top of this parabola, so it's almost the partition coefficient of the major element, like where you substitute the element to. Okay, so it's almost that one. And it's R0 is this ionic site here, and this famous site modulus basically is related to the width of the parabola, okay? So if you look more precisely at this, the value they get from the lattice strain model for this E value, it fits quite well with bulk modulus measurements, but not always. If we see that the fit for 3+ cations is really poor, and I'll show you more examples now. So that trying to answer your question a bit. So to show you sets of data that were regressed with this lattice strain model, so that's for garnet, by Wim van Westerenen, who worked extensively on garnet melt measurements. So yeah, I would say at first order, it's really good. Now it gets off. It gets off when you go to low partitioning, which happens at very high pressures. So in this paper, they say, oh, well, it gets off because maybe in these high pressure experiments, it's very difficult to see whether or not we have melt contamination in the crystals. So maybe we are just seeing melt contamination by a few weight percent here. Okay. In any case, that's another example, very good agreement between data and the lattice strain model. That's for olivine and melt. And just mention here that this lattice strain model can be refined in quite complex ways. So Wim van Westerenen, for example, he regressed even R0, E and D0 as a function of composition, pressure, temperature, so that can get quite complicated. So maybe instead of trying to refine all of this, maybe we should try to consider the melt instead of keeping ignoring it. So we mentioned already the problem with site elasticity for the 3+ cations. That's the case of majorite melt partitioning. So remember, the site elasticity reflects the width of this parabola. And the higher the pressure here, the greater the parabola, the wider the parabola is. The same happens for olivine melt partitioning as a function of pressure. And if it gets greater, the because you have a negative, a minus term here, it means that your site elasticity decreases. So for both cases, majorite melt or live-in melt, what the experimentalists see from their partitioning measurements is that the apparent site elasticity decreases with pressure. Okay? You really don't expect that. Yeah, you expect compressibility to, I mean, incompressibility to be even higher at high pressures. So there's a problem here. Okay? So people have been arguing, oh, maybe because, you know, chemical composition changes with pressure as well, something like that, but it's not obvious, and it clearly cannot explain olivine melt effect. So in this Japanese paper, they came up with a new formula for the lattice strain model. They incorporate the apparent site elasticity for the melt to reduce it. Now that could work, maybe that's the way. Now, how you measure that? A site elasticity in the melt. Yes, it's already not obvious for crystals, so for the melt. So basically now I'm going to try to talk about the melt structure. So people knew that the composition of the melt influences partitioning for a long time, actually. They really knew, they had this situation from a long time ago. So Max Schmidt, to test this, decided to measure partitioning of elements between two coexisting melts. In this case, he has no influence of minerals. He's just looking at two melts. So we have different cases of liquid immiscibility. One is gabbro and granite, you probably have seen in the field, buckets of gabbros within the granite. So those are the experiments. I'll mention a bit later how we managed to have very nice two isolated liquids like that. In any case, he did this experiment, and you have very clear differences between the gabbro and the granite, very clear. So clearly, melt composition controls element partitioning strongly. You have two orders of magnitude difference in partition coefficients. It's a very strong effect. So to explain, try to explain a bit that, mention a bit of magma structure. So you've seen how silicate in the mantles are organized when the tetrahedra are organized. It's very different in melts. You don't have chain, you don't have sheets in melts, you have rings. So this is this polymerization of the melt, and when oxygen are not bonded in the chain, they're called non-bridging oxygens. Okay. Now, if you have cations that substitute to silicon, they're called network formers. If you have cations that go elsewhere, they're called network modifiers, and they kind of break the polymerization because you need to balance charges. So anyway, that's the framework for the picture, and basically the more non-bridging oxygens you have, the easier it is to put trace rare earth elements in a melt because you have non-bridging oxygen available to bond. So this is a classical explanation for why you have much more rare earth element in a gabbro, because it's depolymerized, you have more non-bridging oxygen and they can bond to these elements. Okay, so yeah, remember this very nice sample with two sides, two very clear sides. The way he did it is using a centrifugal press. So that's a piston cylinder. So I forgot, but that's about 3-4 meters long. You're seeing it from the top. So it's at the ETH in Zurich. You have a counterweight here, and it can go like 200 per minute, circle per minute, very fast. And that's how he segregates his liquids. And just to mention another example of melt immiscibility, if you don't do that, that's the kind of picture you get. Okay? That's, in this case, it's carbonate silicate immiscibility, but that's usually always what you get. So how you do measurements in this configuration, it's impossible. So he needed to have these two faces clearly separated. That's why he used the centrifuge. And that's how you, what you get if you use the centrifuge. Anyway, so a strong control as well of melt composition if you compare partitioning between carbonatite and silicate melt. Okay, so I've mentioned non-bridging oxygen, network modifiers, network formers. I briefly mentioned the ring structure. So this SEM image is actually a nanofilm of SiO2 glass. And you're looking at the silicon atoms here and oxygen atoms. You see, so it's a real image. It's not a cartoon draft. It's a real image. It's pure SiO2, and you see very nicely these rings. Okay, so yeah, so silicate males are organized in rings. You can have cavities outside of these rings as well. So you can have a glimpse here that it's very different to insert a trace element in this kind of structures than in a mineral. In a mineral, you have well-identified crystallographic sites. And you can, in terms of ionic radius, you know, basically, you can guess where your elements will go. You know, the big trace elements will go there in the garnet. That's quite easy. In the melt, it's a bit more complex. And it's very complex because we are getting this kind of images just right now. And that's on the glass at ambient pressure. We need this kind of data at ambient, at high pressure, in the liquid, at high temperature. So that's probably going to come, but not yet.
So in the last slide, you showed that it's the ring structures will make it hard to move to partition into that structure. But equally, wouldn't it be hard to partition out of that structure? So wouldn't a melt with a lot of rings have some kind of capacitance?
Yes, it depends which element you're looking at. For noble gases, for instance, they prefer when you have the cavities, the cages, because they fit in there. And they don't go much into gabbroic compositions, for instance. So it really depends if your element bonds or not to oxygen.
So just to help myself and also a few people in the audience. So when you say bridging oxygen, it is oxygen atom that is not being shared between silicon oxygen tetrahedra. So it's available to bond with whatever coming in. What that means is that, can I simplify this argument into like magnesium to silicon ratio, for example? If you have high magnesium to silicon ratio, then you would have more or fewer bridging oxygen. Can you do this, construct simple sort of like chemical dependence of the problem? Like, I mean, can you relate partition coefficient to the for example, simple chemical index like MgSi ratio?
Yeah. I think they use actually other index than NbO over T. So you're right, magnesium, all the cations that do not substitute to silicon. So you would put Mg, Ca, Na over iron 3+, aluminum, and silicon. I think, I forgot which name is that, ASI, I think it's the ASI index. Well, which expresses the chemistry a bit more. So I've mentioned only experiments because I'm an experimentalist myself. Theoreticians are working on the topic as well. They're making great progresses. I'm showing here molecular dynamics data, but I'm sure more is going to come. It's coming from Abinishu as well. Will come at least soon, or is coming. We were talking about trace element partitioning always. So we're talking about trace concentrations. So you want to put one atom over a large number of atoms. And when you have a computer, that's not quite easy to do. Okay. So with molecular dynamics, you can still have quite a large pool of atoms. And you can work not at the ppm level, that's for sure, but you can work at the 0.1% level. Something like that, which is probably, which is okay because, as we said, for this liquefied elements, they obey the Henry's law, so it doesn't matter the concentration too much. So what they did here, they compare the substitution of yttrium in a granite and a gabbro to see if they can calculate what Max Schmidt measured experimentally in his centrifugal experiment. Okay. So they have this equation here. They calculate the delta G to this corresponding to this equation. Now they do make some assumptions here. And one of the big assumptions is that they assume, you have here the equilibrium constant, they assume that the aluminum does not partition, which is a bit wrong, between granite and gabbro. They also assume ideality, but anyway, they can calculate from there the estimate partition coefficient of yttrium between gabbro and granite. And those are their calculations compared to experiments. It's quite good. It's looking quite good. So we're getting there. They are not doing a crystal melt, and they can't right now. They're just doing melt. Now, what's very interesting when you do theoretical calculation is that you can get the structure at the same time. You know where your atoms are. So you can get lots of information on the structure. And what they saw here is that the yttrium bonds to fewer oxygen in depolymerized melt, so in gabbro-like melt, right here, which is expressed here, the number of oxygen. So basically the bonding changes, bonding of yttrium changes as a function of melt polymerization. Okay. It's eight oxygen around yttrium in a fully polymerized melt, and it's close to six in a depolymerized melt. So you change the coordination of yttrium. And you can understand that if you change bonding, you change partitioning. Okay, now with pressure. Those are compilation of lutetium partitioning between different kind of minerals and melt. First order, a strong decrease with pressure. You see it for garnet in orange and red, but it's also true when you look at data for clinopyroxenes and for olivines. So be careful on this graph. Garnet is really the guy that takes up all the lutetium. So it's just to be able to see all the data sets, I've multiplied the green by 5 and by 25, just so that we can see the pressure trend. Okay? And the pressure trend is the same. And I would say it doesn't only decrease, but it decreases extremely strongly at low pressure and then it kind of flattens. Okay. But there's a clear change of partitioning behavior of lutetium with pressure. And because it happens with all these three minerals, it cannot be attributed only to the mineral. It must be due to the melt. So what happens in the melt changes properties, it changes compressibility, and it changes local structure. We just saw that lutetium can be bonded to 6 or 8 oxygen, but the compressibility of the whole thing changes. So just to show you the compressibility of basalt, compilation of data here on molten basalt, the squares, compared to crystalline faces, is the purple curve. So crystalline basalt. Okay, so basically, at low pressures, a liquid is much more compressible than crystals. So that's why people kept neglecting the melt in this partitioning process, because they said melt has a very, very low very high compressibility, so you can accommodate things in there without any strain. Yeah. Clearly, that changes at high pressure. At high pressure here in the lower mantle, melt compressibility is very close to that of crystalline crystals. So that doesn't hold anymore. You have to take into account the melt compressibility. Yep. Well, the only thing that causes the pressure trend. Now, the absolute values clearly are dependent on the mineral. garnet, because it's shifted, yeah, it's actually not shifted, it's multiplied. So the fact that it decreases very strongly between 0 and 5 or 10 GPA and then it comes flat is independent of the mineral. Now, in absolute values, garnet always take much more. Okay? It's just the pressure trend that is similar. But it still keeps much more lutetium than the others.
But can we see like they're
partitioning between different minerals is the same or similar with pressure?
Yeah, the pressure trend is similar, yes.
I mean like the partitioning coefficient between different minerals, not just minerals and melt.
Sorry?
Like the partitioning coefficient between the garnet and the CPX, is that constant with pressure?
Let's see. It's about constant because it goes from, if you look at, it's multiplied, but it's about divided by 3. It's about the same.
Thank you.
Okay, so
I know this Bashun is slightly trying to relate this partition behavior with the melt property. I just wonder because if you look at the left figure, the trend flattened out probably at 10 gigapascal, but in the right figure, there's nothing very drastic at 10 gigapascal. It's more like at 20 gigapascal. So it's kind of there is a kind of like offset between the partition behavior flattening out and melt structure change.
Yep.
So I would just wonder why this happens.
I'm sorry, I'm not sure I get it. You said between 10 and 20 GPA?
I mean, the drastic change in this partition behavior,
yeah,
happens around 10 gigapascal.
Yeah.
But in the if you look at the right figure, usually what people see also for the those simulation, first principle of simulation, for the silicate melts.
Ah, you see.
Yeah, it usually it changes structure, those coordination number, like say the silicon oxygen coordination number,
yeah,
they flatten out probably at a
much higher pressure.
Yeah,
that's not related. I'm not talking here about the influence of silicon coordination change. It's what you see here, the compressibility change is mostly due to this cavity's collapse. The effect of silicon coordination change affects melt compressibility above 25, 30 GPA. Okay, and it might be very important, but not for this particular range. Okay? So anyway, that justifies this equation where you put the melt apparent elasticity. Okay, so how you can explore melt structure under pressure, because that's really where it matters. It matters under pressure, the melt structure for partitioning. You have two experimental methods. You can do X-ray diffraction or you can do X-ray absorption. Both can be done at high pressures. Here is an example of just a resistive heating DAC. You get diffracted signal and a diffused signal here. I don't know if you see it, it's from the melt. The spots here are all coming from the Bragg peaks of the diamond anvils. Just a picture of the heating in the cell. And if you do X-ray absorption, you can do it both using diamond anvil cells or with the large volume presses these days. Just a technical detail, you need to work with nanocrystalline diamonds if you want to do X-raps at high pressures. It's the most straightforward way to go because otherwise your sample is dominated with Bragg peaks. It's horrible. Anyway, that's doable. So just a quick picture on the structure of liquids. Like this graph compares the diffraction of crystalline iron and molten iron. Basically, instead of Bragg peaks, in a liquid, you have diffuse scattering. Okay. That's the blue pattern here. And if you Fourier transform this diffuse scattering, you get what we call the distribution function, which is gives you the probability to find atoms as a function of radial distance. Okay. So if in a crystal you would have Dirac's, just peaks. In a liquid, you have distribution of atoms, kind of Gaussian shapes, not really. But so that's what you get. So in a silicate melt, the first distance here would be silicon oxygen, for instance. That's the first bond, the shortest bond you see. So basically, you can see up to 5 angstrom at best. You can get distances and coordination numbers. So an example of lutetium in melts. So in this case, it's haplogranite. But we've done also anorthic diopside. We're working here with iron-free compositions. The big difference between X-ray diffraction and X-ray absorption is that X-ray diffraction, you see everything. It's not chemically sensitive. I mean, it is chemically sensitive because of the number of electrons, but you see all the elements contribute. In X-AFs, just the one element you're targeting contribute. So in X-rays, you have everything contributing. So the first peak here is the SiO. But the trace elements are usually here between 2 and 2.5, and that's exactly where iron is. Yep, sorry.
So the left figure shows that you just feed the peaks, and it looks like the background of the repair distribution function is subtracted. So how to choose the baseline of the background?
Okay, good question. Okay. When you process this data, there is another type of background. Maybe that's not what you're mentioning, but the real background you have in this data is coming from the anvils, diamond anvils. It's subtracted here, but it's something like that. And you don't see here because we've subtracted it, but you have a background which is a large-scale background in high-pressure experiments, and on this background you have this signal. When you Fourier transform this signal, the background is here. Because it's very large, it comes up at very low radial distances. After that, you have no other contribution but your ion-ion pair. You don't have to subtract anything here. There's no background in X-ray diffraction. Okay. The real background problem shows up here, below one angstrom. So it's not like Raman or infrared, or sometimes you want to have the baseline, if that's what you meant. You don't have this here. You have other problems, but not this one. So basically, you don't want to have iron in your composition, otherwise you wouldn't see your trace elements. Okay, but that's why we work with iron-free composition. So when you don't have lutetium, you have this data up, and if you put lutetium, you can see the difference, so you can by difference or by fit, you can get the lutetium oxygen contribution. So that gives you the distance and the area as a function of the coordination number. Okay. And what we saw is that in the granite, which is the HPG analog, nothing changes between 0 and 6 GPa. It's always coordination number of 8. Which is what it's supposed to be from ambient pressure literature. Now for basalt, it changes from 6 to 8 with pressure. At low pressure it's 6, at high pressure it's 8, so you have a drastic change of local environment of lutetium. So that's a possibility to explain this change with pressure. The behavior of lutetium, okay? That's because the local structure changes. Interestingly, this doesn't affect all the elements in the same way. So those are collection of data for different rare earth elements and high field strength elements. For hafnium, you don't see much change with pressure, which is good because geochemists compare lutetium and hafnium. So hafnium doesn't, it's not affected much. Lutetium is a lot. Samarium, if you focus on samarium, the squares, there is a big change, but it tends to occur at lower pressure than for lutetium. So basically, work remains to be done, but mesh structure really affects element partitioning, and it probably affects it differently depending on the elements you're looking at. Okay? So you might decouple some of the geochemical systems at depth, at high pressures. Yeah, just a slide out of my comfortable zone here, but a slide of on neodymium and hafnium isotopes, and they don't give you exactly the same information about the early Earth. If you just look at the very beginning here, neodymium changes very early on in the, during the Hadean era, while you only see that during the Archean, really, for lutetium. Okay, it might be, I'm not saying that's the case, but it might be due to the fact that the depth of melting changed in the early Earth, from high pressure to lower pressure during the Archean. Okay, so that might reflect the decoupling of these systems because of the depth of melting that changed during time. Yep.
You're comparing two different systems here. One is extinct, yep. And the other one is not. So what happens if you put 143 neodymium and compare it with hafnium? That would be more appropriate.
More appropriate?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because here it's really two completely different phenomena.
Yeah. Yeah.
The 142 will have not much to do. 142 comes from samarium 146 with a half-life of 106 million years.
Yep.
So it's 106. It's extinct after 500 million years, and that's what you see.
That's when it gets complicated because you have all these remixing effects.
You're tracing something else than partitioning in solid.
But initially, you had to fractionate the neodymium from the samarium, didn't you? To get these positive or negative values, you need to fractionate neodymium versus samarium.
Yeah, but you can't couple that to hafnium.
No, I'm just saying that here you did fractionate neodymium and samarium, and here you didn't fractionate hafnium versus lutetium.
We can talk about that later.
Okay, so last part of the talk on iron. So iron is enriched in melts. That's why basalts are always enriched in iron a bit. So we're going to look into that and see if iron spin transition has any effect or what happens to iron partitioning in the lower mantle. And actually, iron is off the Onuma parabola. That's been noticed for a very long time by BT. That's the olivine melt partitioning. So iron is a bit different. Now, iron is extremely important for our science because of its abundance and because its heavy mass. It's major control on density of Earth materials. So the continental lithosphere is very stable. But it's cooler, so it should be colder. It's colder, so it should be denser, but it's depleted in iron, so that counterbalances the thermal effect. So that's one of the effects of iron being partitioned into the melt. And another one is these dense piles, which are also probably iron-enriched and are stabilized also gravitationally there. So when iron, when you look at these binary phase diagrams for olivine and pyroxene, oops, sorry, I put it twice, mistake. It's always the same figure, that the liquid is always enriched in iron compared to the solid, always strong enrichment in iron. So the exchange partition coefficient, which compares iron and magnesium, is always in favor. Iron goes a lot into the melt. So it's always below one. Okay, so that's very well known. On top of that, there is an interesting pressure effect. So that's classical petrology. When you increase pressure, you change the, you have a new eutectic appearing here. So your liquid gets more enriched in, towards the olivine, so more MgO and FeO. So more FeO. And on top of that, at greater depth, you have garnet, and garnet will melt first, has lots of iron, so even more iron in the melt when you have partial melting. And those are compilations of data on peridotites, on xenolith. And basically, continental cratonic xenolith are less rich in iron. Okay, phanerozoic data, much iron rich, and cratonic have much lower iron content, and it's explained by being created at higher, during the residue of melting at higher pressures. Now, in the lower mantle, there have been some controversy between groups. So I'm showing the data of the two groups here, but it looks like there might be no effect, or there might be some effect of, in any case, it's always below one, the partitioning of iron. So iron still, whatever the pressure, prefers the liquid. That doesn't change. It always prefers the liquid. There might be an effect of the spin transition of iron, which occurs about 70 gigapascals. Well, that remains to be fixed. But in any case, melts will be systematically enriched in iron. So that's very useful in petrology because you can get from the iron-magnesium ratio estimate of temperatures. That's an example from the Galapagos area. Estimate of temperatures in the hotspot, so about 200 degrees higher than in the ambient mantle. You can look in past samples, still looking at this iron concentration. And in this picture, you see that hotspots were still were hotter than the mantle, which itself was hotter than the current ambient mantle. So very useful iron behavior. So what it stems for, just throwing some ideas. So iron crystal chemistry is complex because you can have two valences in crystals. You can have either 2+ or 3+. On top of that, it can be in two sites, two crystallographic sites. It can bond. It can be exovalent, which is the vast majority in minerals. You have very rare examples where it's tetrahedral, but by vast majority, it's always bonded to 6 oxygen. Now, in iron 3+, inversely, is tetravalent. That's why it's substitute to silicon. Okay. So those are two examples of phyllite and hedendergite pyroxene. So it's quite complex, the iron crystal chemistry, because of that. In the melt, those are X-ray diffraction data. So sorry, that's the radio distribution function. Okay, so it oscillates versus one. So those were done on during levitation experiments. You have a sphere levitating and it's molten with a laser. And you can get the distribution function and you see the SiO bond, 1.6 angstrom, and then you see two clear distances. That's for olivine, that's for pyroxene, that's for basalt. You systematically see these two distances. So that's, if you compare with minerals, this first distance is FeO4, the second distance is FeO6. So you have these two sites in liquids, apparently. Okay, so that's interesting because that's what X-rays give you. What EXAPS gives you, there are no in-situ data in EXAPS yet. The problem is, in EXAPS, I didn't mention it before, but in EXAPS, under high pressure, you need to have enough energy to go through your environment, through your anvils and everything. And iron, the edge of iron is too low. You can't, I mean, people try, but it's very tough, very difficult to do iron in situ. But people do iron ex situ, so they do the experiments, they recover the glass, and assuming nothing happens between the melt and the glass, and they cannot do better than that, So those are the exacts patterns. And here, in this case, they look at this little peak, which is called the pre-edge feature. And that's a compilation of data. And the pre-edge feature for standards, for known minerals, are these big gray circles. So for known minerals, so iron 3 plus is here, iron 2 plus is here, and tetrahedral or hexagonal. So you see a balance of 5 here, which is very unusual, inexistent basically for minerals. But you might see that in melt, and you certainly see that in glasses. So in exaps, they see all their glasses, which are here, fall in between 4 and 5. Okay, basalt is 5. So that exaps gives you a mean coordination number. Okay, and X-ray diffraction tend to tell you that's actually a mixture of Fe2 and Fe6. Okay, so somewhere. In any case, iron valence is different in the melt than in the crystals. Okay, that's the take-home message. And because bonding is different, then bond stiffness is different. And an interesting implication of that is that if you melt a rock, the liquid will be enriched in this iron with a different bonding environment, and it will be enriched in heavy isotopes. And you see that very nicely in these two examples of the moon basalts or the terrestrial basalts. Okay, so my conclusions. So I started with citation of Francis, so I'll end with another citation of Francis. But remains a grand challenge to predict the chemical properties of elements at very great depth. So that's very true, that's still very true. I've shown you most of the data we have are up to 3 GPa, okay, very little after that. So crystal chemistry of element substitution in minerals is very well described. The lattice strain model has been very fruitful. Melt crystal chemistry remains to be done. We're starting to have lots of input on melt structure and trace element in the melts. But now we need to go to the next step, which is to get a formalism, kind of a lattice strain model for the melt. Okay, this remains to be done. And it matters at depth. It doesn't matter for low pressure magmatism, but it really matters at depth. So in terms of where we have magmas, most magmas are produced at very low pressures, eventually down to 5 GPa in subduction zones or below the lithosphere a little bit. But you do have occurrences of melts deeper and top transition zone or down to the core mantle boundary in the ultra low velocity zones. And clearly, what we need here is partitioning between post perovskite and liquid. There's nothing on the topic. And as I said, very little on transition zone minerals. Okay, so that's really things we need to know. And I didn't cover at all other topics that might be relevant to heterogeneities if you look at noble gases and what noble gases tell you about heterogeneities in the deep mantle. And that's extremely challenging. And I forgot the citation. It's from Heber, 1997, I think. So it's an old paper, but basically it still stands. If you compile all the literature data for the noble gases, you get 4 to 7 orders of magnitude difference between data sets, okay? And that's because it's extremely complicated to do these experiments. When you do these experiments, you recover glasses with bubbles. Bubbles can be nanometer size, they can be few microns. What was at equilibrium, what was not, you simply don't know, okay? So that's a vast area you could go. Thank you.
So I'm wondering if you're doing a partitioning study and you have a data set that ranges between large volume pressures and then very high diamond anvil cell pressures, and you're looking for the PT dependence on partitioning, would you look for a single proxy to silicate melt structure, or would you fit them piecewise since the lower pressure data are tetrahedrally coordinated and the higher pressure data are octahedrally coordinated?
I would say that when you're talking about 25 gigapascals, so by that time all the cavities are collapsed, but you start to have coordination changes of silicon. So it depends whether your elements will substitute on this tetrahedral site or not. If it doesn't, I would say that this pressure, the compressibility are not very different, so it doesn't matter, you can fit everything with the same line. Now, if it's an element which goes on an element which changes coordination, that you shouldn't probably. It depends where your element goes.
Okay, so for example, if you're looking at silicon, then you should.
Yeah. Silicon is an issue between, silicon changes coordination between 25 and 40 GPa inlets.
You briefly mentioned MBOT, and we need to consider it, and you put in the equation you show. In the literature, sometimes you see that people fit those partitioning coefficient into those MBOT, but sometimes they don't. I just wonder your comments on those. When do we need to consider this MBOT, when we don't?
You should very often consider it. I mean, the thing is that if you deal with the lower, if you deal in general with the mantle, the NBO over T doesn't change much because your melts are basically basalts. You see? So it depends. If you have the first liquids, between the first liquids, that will be much more depolarized than the last liquid. Then that might be, that's when you want to be careful. It depends on your application, let's say. Okay? If you have large, if it's a large degree of melting, it will always be a basalt, so it's okay. If you look at small melting, you better be very cautious on the composition of the melt which was used in the partitioning experiments.
In the beginning, you laid out the sort of a thermodynamic description of this and sort of characterized things in terms of differences in free energies. And then you added these terms which were sort of empirical but often physically motivated. And I guess the question is, it seems in doing that you're sort of stepping outside of the thermodynamic framework. And I guess I wondered why that was the sensible approach. Could, for example, this N-bolt effect be incorporated into the sort of standard thermodynamic description that you laid out at the beginning?
I suppose so. I'm biased because I'm biased towards the processes rather than the using partitioning. That's my bias. That's why I insisted on the latter. But if you have a problem, you need partitioning coefficient, then certainly the first approach is sufficient if you have large enough data sets. And then the basic rule that never apply partition coefficients where they haven't been measured. But that's valid for anything. That's valid for equation of states. And
so using a laser heating Damon Alva cell, I always have problem of heterogeneity because the heating is difficult to be homogeneous. Do you have the same problem or how to solve this?
Yeah, well, I'm not doing these experiments myself.
Yeah.
I deal only with liquids. yes, that's true. Well, you need to have a large laser spot. You need to really know how to align your lasers. It's really not trivial. It's not always easy, especially when you work with that small samples, which I shown. But apart from telling you that, having large spot as you can, and it's complex because on top of that, they can't, in these experiments I've shown, there is no pressure transmitting medium, so you are not isolating your diamond end walls from your sample. So it is certainly a problem. So apart from really optimizing the alignment of the lasers, I'm talking about the alignment of the lasers. We use two lasers, one on each side of the diamond end wall cell. That's why you need to do that. But from doing that very nicely and having defocusing your laser a bit so that you have large spot. I mean, people are thinking of techniques like instead of having the laser heating, having internal furnaces, like sandwiching your sample in the diamond and angle cell between two layers of metal or something that you could heat, not with the laser, but resistive heating, thank you. It's not there yet, but and that would make a mini oven, mini furnace inside your DAC.
So just to make a comment on his question, that it's extremely difficult, and I mean for those of us who do laser heat, when he's talking about sort of the heterogeneity in heating, I mean this can be in space and time. And often when you're trying to melt, you get lots of flashing, and as Christelle has mentioned, you know, some of the experiments that you showed, you know, with no insulation, this influences the temperatures that are measured drastically. And so if you are then trying to take your data set and fitting it as a function of temperature and pressure, that also becomes an issue. So it's not even just measuring like the partitioning, which is hard itself, like measuring, you know, having the appropriate standards and knowing if you're going to have any contamination from the melt versus the crystal, you know, having big enough samples. That part is hard, but measuring the temperature appropriately and then knowing the pressures while it is also at high temperatures also takes some care. So keeping all these things in track, I mean, it's no surprise that, you know, that there's these huge spreads in partitioning data measurements that are out there because because they are so complicated. But we have to realize what those uncertainties are and report them, honestly. Sorry, no easy answer.
I guess then we're